Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This is Eye on Veterans Weekend, a roundup of the week's most important stories affecting those who served. Presented by University of Maryland Global Campus.
There are nearly 20 million,
military veterans
in the U.S.
Each week, we focus on their stories.
Powered by ConnectingVets.com.
This
is CBS
Eye on Veterans.
Eye on Veterans.
Welcome to another edition of CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm Navy veteran Phil Briggs. Eye on Veterans is a weekly program focused on the men and women who have served our nation in uniform and their families. We're powered by ConnectingVets.com, always a great place to find military news, veteran news, resources, and stories about the veteran lifestyle. This hour, we're all going to get some therapy. That's right, we're talking about mental health. We'll hear how virtual reality is being used.
We have a pretty expansive virtual reality system where we can put the person in a wide range of simulations that mimic what they went through, and we can customize it in real time.
We'll even hear how the answer might lie in the use of magnets.
What we do is, with that magnetic field, when that hits the brain, it makes the nerves in the brain activate. And by going in and using sort of this pinpoint targeting, we can restore those areas that aren't functioning correctly to essentially their normal status.
And we'll hear about madness from the trenches of the VA and a devoted social worker who spent 15 years treating our veterans and helping them fight things like addiction, suicide, and PTSD.
He kept the faith. He worked at staying sober. And occasionally in my last years at the VA, I would be on the phone with him conducting business and think, wait a minute, you were once my patient. That's a miracle.
It's all ahead this hour on CBS Eye on Veterans. Now in our next segment, we'll talk about a new treatment for PTSD that uses virtual reality to help veterans confront the painful memories that are linked to their post-traumatic stress. Thanks in part to the popularity of gaming, virtual reality therapy appeals to some veterans who might normally shy away from the traditional talk-based therapy. And here to talk to us about that is Dr. Albert Skip Rizzo, the Director of Medical Virtual Reality at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. Doc, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Really glad to have you. As I saw this, I saw this in somewhere online last month, and I saw headsets, and I saw veterans, and the video game-looking reenactments of certain scenarios. Talk to me about VR therapy.
Well, the approach we take in this type of treatment is to use virtual reality as a way to create an emotionally evocative experience with the patient where they're encouraged to go back and confront and reprocess difficult emotional memories from their trauma experiences, but at a pace they can handle. And this, in its traditional format, is called prolonged exposure. It's a trauma-focused treatment that has pretty good evidence, although there's some controversy about its full effectiveness and other issues. But what we do is, instead of relying exclusively on imagination, where the patient is closing their eyes and narrating their experience as if they're going through it right then and there, we have a pretty expansive virtual reality system where we can put the person in a wide range of simulations that mimic what they went through, and we can customize it in real time. So in this process, basically the patient repeatedly goes back to the scene of the crime, if you will, but at a pace they can handle, while the clinician has a control panel to change the time of day or the distance of an explosion or a jet or a helicopter flying over and so forth, so as to mimic the story that the patient is telling.
I think about the artwork that's involved, the settings, a road in Iraq, an IED, helicopters over top. Like, how are they able to stitch all that together in the matter of one clinical session?
Well, the full course of therapy follows sort of a standard protocol of 10 sessions, whether they're delivered on a weekly basis or in a masked setting, like where you fly into a treatment area, stay in a hotel, do VR every morning, do other therapies in the afternoon. So the time frame of the therapy may vary, but there, you know, we recommend at least 10 sessions. And with the clinician having a like what we like to call a Wizard of Oz control panel, where they can immediately pick the scenario that's most relevant for the client, change the time of day based on what they tell you. Were they on a foot patrol? Were they in a vehicle? Were they in a turret? Were they driving? Were they a passenger? What kind of sound effects were going on? And the clinician can do that in two or three keystrokes. And then as the client starts to tell their story, then they might hit a button with a sound effect of a radio call or an explosion off in the distance or driving under a bridge. The clinician might hit a button where an insurgent attack occurs. So it's all very controllable in real time for the clinician to kind of mimic what the patient is talking about. And the value in this is that with a number of patients, it's very hard for them to pull up some of these difficult emotional memories because they've spent a lot of time trying to avoid thinking about them, avoid going to places that remind them of these experiences. But here in the VR simulation, we can recreate that. So sort of just like an aircraft simulator would test and train piloting ability under a range of controllable conditions, we have a VR simulation delivered in a virtual reality headset where the clinician can pace the exposure based on the patient or client's needs.
Now, whether you go to YouTube and follow Dr. Skip Rizzo and see some of the videos of his work there, or whether you go to soldierstrong.org, it's evident that in some cases it is working. But I had to ask, can't it also be bad for the patient? That even in a recent Journal of American Medical Association Insights, they did a study, and they said that only 31% of the patients recovered or actually improved after prolonged exposure therapy and cognitive processing therapy. What is it about this particular therapy that might have better odds?
You know, I read the JAMA article as well, and they didn't cover any of the VR studies. And we've had a couple of studies showing rather good results, and I think part of it may be that with some clients going through this kind of trauma-focused therapy, if they're also depressed or they're very well practiced at avoidance, they don't really engage in the emotions of the memory. Because let's face it, this is hard medicine for a hard problem. There's no doubt. This is not just, you know, talk about the future, forget about the past. This is digging into the past and confronting it and reprocessing those memories, but in a safe place. So we have data that's under review right now showing that not only did we get statistically significant and clinically meaningful reductions with both treatments, prolonged exposure and VR exposure, but VR had a little bit of an edge when it came to working with people that are depressed, comorbid depression, which is a common thing. You know, you have PTSD, it creates a lot of issues in your life, and it's really easy to slip into depression. So for people that are depressed and have a hard time activating their effortful memory of the event, VR, I think, fits perfectly in. And the other plus here is that when people were given a choice in our recent study, even though they were randomized to either one of the conditions, if they were asked, when they were asked, if you had your pick, what would you pick? 77% picked the VR approach. So we may actually be able to break down barriers to care by drawing in perhaps digital generation service members that are comfortable with video game type technology and so forth. So, you know, we're trying to hit this from a couple of different angles, but, you know, I'll be the first one to say that, you know, maybe prolonged exposure or CPT, cognitive processing therapy, might not be the magic bullet for some people. And I think we have to move towards using what we know from the science works best, but in a way that integrates a more comprehensive package of treatment.
Now coming up, we'll hear how a partnership with an organization that started out collecting socks for deployed service members is now helping veterans get access to these virtual reality therapy sessions when CBS Eye on Veterans returns. Welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm your host, Navy veteran Phil Briggs. Now, in our last segment, we were talking about treating PTSD with virtual reality therapy. We'll pick back up with our conversation about it with Dr. Skip Rizzo, the director of virtual reality therapy at the Institute for Creative Technologies.
And we're working with a company that's developed a device that can be put onto the headset that puffs out these little micro blasts of scent. And we know that some clients, when they smell that diesel fuel or that burning rubber or the cordite, that really activates them. That activates the memory. So we've really got a multi-sensory approach here to engage the user in this. But again, you know, I want to underscore here, we don't throw people in the deep end of the pool here. You know, we start them off at a pace they can handle and help them to have successive, you know, success experiences. I think part of the value of the treatment is, of course, number one, the basic science of conditioning and learning that prolonged exposure and all these trauma-focused therapies rely on. But number two is the sense of empowerment that people get when they're in these environments, when they first go through it. And it's, you know, it's pretty emotionally evocative, and people are sweating and having emotional responses. But then the next time they do it, it gets a little bit easier. And the next time a little bit more. And then finally, you know, you get to a point where after we've raised their anxiety to a certain degree, all of a sudden it's manageable. And they start to feel empowered that they could go back and actually talk about things that they never talked to anyone about in the past. And so I think those are the three elements, the basic conditioning and learning, the empowerment, and the evocative nature of the content that helps people to talk about these difficult things in a way that they haven't been able to do before. And that opens up the door to better processing of the emotional memory in a way that might be more adaptive.
Hmm. Yeah. And in fact, in one of the videos I saw that you put up on YouTube, a combat veteran, Stephen Cotta, had stated that he said after the therapy, it gave him tools he never knew he had before. Talk to me about what some of those tools might be that a veteran could walk away from this VR therapy and implement.
Well, you know, in addition to the exposure approach, you know, we teach people relaxation skills, how to manage their breathing, of course, is a big area that, you know, you find that it can have a positive calming impact on folks. So we teach them some of those kinds of skills that help them to manage difficult emotions when they're confronted with these kinds of things in the real world. But also, I think the idea that we're just doing VR therapy alone is not really accurate. What we're doing is a comprehensive treatment approach that VR is part of, but there is a significant amount of time in the session where the clinician and the patient discuss what they went through, how they're conceptualizing it, how does what they went through affect what they go through in their everyday life. And in the course of that processing, there can be a lot of good learning about how you manage emotion. You know, let's face it, we're not erasing anyone's bad memories here. they're always going to have these difficult memories throughout the rest of their life. The question is, should those memories harness someone's emotions in a way that makes it very difficult for them to function in everyday life 10, 20, 30 years after the event? And this is what we try to do, is to change up things in a way where, yes, you have that bad experience and you can remember it and you can feel sad about it, but it doesn't have to limit you for the rest of your life. PTS is not a life sentence. And I keep trying to tell folks that, you know, there is treatment out there. And if you dig into it, you can get better and your life can improve. You know, it amazes me sometimes with certain clients that, you know, they'll go months, years, or even decades with this emotional pain without seeking any help. You know, the same person, they have a toothache, they're in the dentist chair the next day. Nobody likes to go to the dentist, but you want the damn pain to stop. But it amazes me that people go so long because either they don't believe there's any hope for them, or they just don't want to go through the pain again. But, you know, I'm here to say there are treatments out there, and with a good clinician, you find the right one that's suited to your needs, and you have an empowered choice in some of these things. And, you know, the clinician hopefully is well informed of the science that underlies these treatments, so that you build trust, you build an alliance with your client so that they trust you that, you know, if they go through this, they're going to survive it. They're going to get through it, and hopefully they're going to get better.
Hard medicine for a hard problem, and it's certainly something that you're spreading throughout the country now. I'm reading here from soldierstrong.org. Talk to me about that.
Soldier Strong is a foundation that's been around for about, I think, 13 years, doing really positive activities for veterans. Something very simple that they got started with was sending vets or service members in Iraq and Afghanistan a bunch of clean socks, because that's what they really wanted. So this guy set up a foundation, and out of his garage shipped out something like 40,000 pairs of socks. Then he got into, his name is Chris Meek, brilliant guy. He got into donating exoskeletons for people with spinal cord injuries to help them be able to stand up and walk around with the assistance of these devices. And Soldier Strong distributed a bunch of those to VA systems around the country. Then when they found out about our work, they really swept in and said, we want to make this available for anybody who wants it. And, you know, anytime I would get a media hit in the past, because this program's been around, for 10 years, I would get emails and phone calls from parents or spouses or individuals saying, I'm in Oklahoma, and, my son is having problems with PTSD. Can you recommend a place where we can do this treatment? And it would be so sad. I'd have to say, we don't have a system in Oklahoma. You know, the closest system might be in Missouri. What Soldier Strong has done, and this is very important when it comes to any kind of clinical care, particularly using technology, is that they've supported the donations of equipment to any VA that wants to implement this treatment. And of course, we provide the software for free, so that a VA that buys into this approach and wants to make it available can be in touch with Soldier Strong and through our VA representatives, Mark Polson at the Center for Innovation at the VA, and get the equipment, get a donation of the equipment, and get clinical training. We just completed two trainings in 1 week, one in Asheville, North Carolina, one in Dallas, Texas, where we train folks in how to do this therapy, how to operate the equipment, and so forth. And so Soldier Strong, you know, this really shows a public-private partnership approach that I think really is important. It can make a difference, and I think we'll see it expanding over time. The Soldier Strong folks are extremely committed to this, and as are we. So we're hoping for a bright future, making this kind of treatment more accessible to the folks that deserve our best efforts. Like I said, PTS is not a life sentence. We can make a difference here, And that's what we're aiming to do.
Amen. Well, I really appreciate the work you guys are doing. Appreciate talking to you about this study. It sounds fascinating. It sounds effective. And you can read more about it at soldierstrong.org. Dr. Skip Rizzo, always great chatting with you. And hey, can I just add maybe one more module to add to the virtual reality segment? Would be on a beach, drinking some Coronas with Kenny Chesney, doing some fishing, and maybe having some suntan oil rubbed on my shoulders. That might be kind of a nice sort of addition to the virtual reality model.
Well, believe it or not, people are building those kinds of scenarios without the suntan oil on the shoulder, but everything else.
Put me out there with a swimsuit model, Kenny Chesney, and a Yeti cooler of beer, man. That'd be awesome. Outstanding.
There you go.
Dr. Skip Rizzo, appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
No shoes, no shirt, no problem.
Now, when we come back, we'll stay in Southern California and meet a former child actress who became a social worker and devoted 15 years to the VA, helping veterans overcome things like addiction, suicide, and PTSD. Welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm your host, Navy veteran Phil Briggs. Now, our next guest traveled an interesting path on her journey to treating veterans. Before she became a licensed clinical social worker in Los Angeles, she was a child actor. A young girl on the set of shows like Gunsmoke and Combat and Peter Gunn. But after her college years, which were during the turbulent era of Vietnam War protests, Andrea Plait would take a job as a social worker in the West Los Angeles Department of Veterans Affairs, which, as she described in her book Madness in the Trenches of America's Troubled Department of Veterans Affairs, is like a country in and of itself. For 15 years, she would help veterans from all eras, all wars, and she would help them mend, all the while enduring what is often a bureaucratic mess. So here to share some of those stories is author Andrea Plait. Andrea, just a pleasure to get to know you today.
Hey, nice to talk to you. I love talking about veterans, and I love talking about the VA.
And I loved right away in your book, in the intro, you talk about when one of your friends is like, why do you want to work with veterans? That's kind of depressing. And you're like, Hollywood, I've been on the sets of TV shows and we're talking about addictions and problems just that are the mirror image of the veteran experience.
But he said, oh, how depressing. And I said, to me, it wasn't any more depressing than being on cattle calls and seeing the evil and that's in another type of industry.
Just like war, there is an ugly, unspeakably wicked part of Hollywood that we just don't talk about. Now, you say what you hope to convey here is that you have no desire to indict the government institution that we know as the VA. Everyone knows that the VA is a bureaucratic mess. What people don't know, perhaps, is the underlying story, the zany passion and persistence of social workers that are serving veterans and trying to crush the pain. Let's begin in the very early years, maybe your first year there at the VA, and share with me one of your very first experiences.
I think the one that I remember in the earlier years was a veteran who had been in the penitentiary for 23 years for manslaughter, for holding his boot, his foot, on the neck of a guy until he died with his partner. In a bad drug deal, a drug deal gone bad. And I ended up seeing him one-on-one after he got out of the penitentiary. And I remember him crying when he said his mother was the only person who came to visit him all the time. And the reason it sticks in my memory is not just because of what he told me, which was astounding. But, and I mean, wasn't used then to people who stepped on people's necks and had broken jaws and stuff like that. But what blew my mind was how determined he was after 23 years to set his life right. And he did. He ended up getting a job, first as a dishwasher, walking 6 miles one way to work until he could afford a broken down car. And it almost made me think that in some bizarre way, maybe only very long-term incarceration is healing. But it was quite moving. And I thought, okay, so I'm in the company of, you know, a manslaughterer. And of course, after a while, I got used to, you know, the experiences and the terms, and the struggle was not to become hardened to it and so used to it that I didn't feel the experience anymore.
That's amazing. I, too, worked at a shelter briefly in my hometown where I volunteered through my church. And, you know, when I got to know some of the older vets that were chronically homeless or dealing with addictions or dealing with things like that, some folks were like, aren't you scared to go out and to sit in the day room? And I was like, no, they're kind of like guys I used to see at rock concerts all the time. You know, they got the long beards and they like to party and, you know. They were a soul that was dealing with issues and things left over from the Vietnam era.
Right.
And it's PTSD. We now have a name for it. I don't know what they used to call it, but a lot of times they're trying to process memories. And as they went along life's journey, made some bad decisions and they didn't process well. And
well,
you
if you want to go back in history sometime, just watch George Carlin, the late comic, do his riff on how it was originally called shell shock, and it was sort of medicalized.
In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language, two syllables, shell shock. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now, takes a little longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt as much. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, and thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you.
You've now worked your entire career through the global war on terror era.
That's right.
What similarities are you finding that are universal among not just veterans of all eras, but among people who have had some real trauma in their life that they just don't know how the hell to deal with?
I would say that, you know, the disorder is the disorder and it doesn't change, but the people who pass through that mental health tunnel are different, and the societies that they are in are different. So the disorder is the same. You have a near-death experience, or you witness a near-death experience, and you become traumatized because you don't process it in the brain at the time. We were taught it's kind of like Jell-O. It solidifies in the brain if you don't mix it all up and deal with it very shortly after it happens. What's different is that now you have, you know, different treatments. It's often combined with substance abuse. It's much easier to tell a veteran when he's older, let's say a Vietnam combat vet now, that he has to engage in harm reduction or not use at all. Try telling that to a 20-year-old back from Iraq or Afghanistan. They're like, what? They're doing it in college, you know? So that's very different. And I think that the inhospitable home environment also contributed to the Vietnam veterans' return home. I mean, they came back and called baby killers. Now we have a much more open society. And so that helps the healing process somewhat for veterans who have returned home. The disorder is the same, but the culture and the medicine, we have medications now. I mean, it wasn't codified until the Vietnam War. So it's quite quite different dealing with veterans of different eras.
Let's talk a little bit about treatments that you've seen that are documented in this book that work.
Vet to vet. There's something healing just about being in groups at the VA, of veterans being with veterans, because it's no one else can really fully understand, or so they feel. And so being together is very important. And in that sense, process groups work, which are just a lot of talking and support facilitated by a clinical person such as myself. And then they have a lot of these behavior therapies like seeking safety. Don't you love that name? seeking safety, and that involves, you don't really go into the trauma. It's a manualized thing. Don't go into the trauma, but you recognize that it's there, and then you talk about ways to seek safety, to cope, when you get this thought, when you can't sleep, what you should do. I think that, you know, kind of works. And Phil, if I could just say, there is probably no cure, but there is treatment, and you can get better, and the experience never goes away. You just learn how to manage it. And it's kind of like someone said once, it's like being behind your eyeballs and having perspective instead of being in front of them and being lost in time.
Now, when we come back, we'll hear Andrea describe what happened when VA bureaucrats wouldn't listen to the clinicians.
It was a line of medications from the pillow to the foot of the bed. Then, in 2007, one of the first returnees we got died of an overdose.
That's ahead on CBS Eye on Veterans. Welcome back to CBS Eye on Veterans. I'm your host, Navy veteran Phil Briggs. Now, we've been talking about the book Madness, In the Trenches of America's Troubled Department of Veterans Affairs, with the author, Andrea Plate. Andrea spent 15 years as a licensed clinical social worker and was one of the caring and compassionate people on the front lines helping veterans recover from things like depression, addiction, and the condition that we've politely termed post-traumatic stress disorder. While her book is full of stories of humanity and hope, she also didn't hold back when talking about the mistakes the VA made when dealing with mental health issues. At some point in time, there were people either above you in a chain of command or, you know, on the Washington, D.C. level that were making decisions to just hand out the drugs, to hand out the benzodiazepines, to hand out the SSRIs.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
The first thing that comes to mind is this visual of, we had to do room inspections because we were a residential program. So once a month, the entire team, me, social worker, other social workers, and addiction therapists, we had to look at the rooms. The requirement of reviewing these rooms was that the veterans had to lay their meds out on the beds. And it was unbelievable. You would walk up to a bed, and there would be a line of medications from the pillow to the foot of the bed and then around again. There were, and they called it threshold psychiatry because they said the doctor would put one foot in and write a script and leave. So the over-medicalization of it, I mean, these over-prescribed veterans were pretty scary, and they were aware of it, and they didn't like it. And I was powerless to do much about that.
I know when the clinician's heart is good, and they love and they care. Why is it that we've seen some of these piss-poor decisions being made by handing out the drugs? Like, why is it they decided to just drug the heck out of the guys to treat this when you were there trying to do otherwise?
That's a great question. Well, the reason I think is you have to realize it's a little bit like China, you know, and this is a coronavirus. No one knows what to do. It's a huge, huge bureaucracy. And when I started, we were not prepared for the influx of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. You've got tons and tons of returnees. You don't know what to do with them. You don't have the funds or the staffing to deal with them. Now, when I started in a 280-bed program, I was one of three social workers. So the easiest thing and the most expedient thing, it would seem, is the drugs. So a lot of it has to do with that. And you couldn't do individual therapy either. Who has the time for that? So a lot of it is simply expediency and lack of funding from Congress. And so it's not like, oh, let's make them zombies. Well, what else can we do? We can't treat, you know, 200 people a day. That, I think, is the real issue. It's a systems, politics, political issue.
Mm. Is there something in your book where you brought that to the attention of senior people and they just told you, you know, march on?
March on, yeah. That's one of the keenest points in my memory, going back to 2007, a few years after the Iraq War and Afghanistan wars. And we social workers went to our bosses in the domiciliary and said, we can't manage the caseload. I had 70 patients to worry about. These are of high acuity, really imminently, potentially dangerous to themselves and to others. Can't handle it. And they said, you think that's bad? You're going to get 100. Under Bush, it was bring the numbers in. Just keep the door revolving. So they did. We warned them. Then in 2007, one of the first returnees we got from Iraq, named Justin Bailey, died of an overdose two floors above my office on a weekend when staff wasn't there. And then 10 days later, Mark Torres, a Vietnam-era veteran, died also of an overdose. And guess what, Phil? All of a sudden, our caseload was reduced to 30. They paid attention. They said, oh, how did this happen? And the place began to change. But we had to sacrifice two precious veterans, their lives, in order to get the attention we needed.
Now, while we can't find much faith in the bureaucrats, from the secretaries of the VA on down right. to like the senior officials that make some of these damn dumb decisions, where can we find hope? Give me a story that I can take from this book about something that's just absolutely miraculous that happened on your watch.
I think what's miraculous is both the small and the large. Let me give you the small. When a guy gets off the street and gets a hot shower and a hot meal and smiles and gets a ray of hope, that's kind of like the small miracle. I mean, it's huge, but in the everyday life of a social worker or a veteran there, these things brought great light. But I think many of them develop trust. We don't hear about them in the headlines. They develop trust. One veteran with whom I worked who had a very difficult, lurid, and tortured past, Army veteran Desert Storm, one day I looked up and I see this guy and he looks familiar and he knows who I am. He's heavier. He's well-dressed, well-groomed. And he says, hi, I'm so-and-so. And I almost had a heart attack. He was working at the VA. He'd been sober 10 or 12 years. And that's a miracle. He somehow, you never know. That's the beauty of it. You never know who it's going to be. He kept the faith. He worked at staying sober. He was an AA kind of guy, so that made it easier in a certain sense. And he has a very productive life. And occasionally in my last years at the VA, I would be on the phone with him conducting business and think, wait a minute, you were once my patient. That's a miracle.
That is absolutely awesome. Andrea Plait, you are a miracle worker. And in your time at the VA, I know that, you know, when you put your hands and you put your heart into the work you did change lives. And it's people like you behind the scenes that often go unknown and unnoticed. And I'm so glad that you're able to put that in this book. Again, we're talking about Madness in the Trenches of America's Troubled Department of Veterans Affairs. Andrea Plait, a licensed certified social worker that has worked over a decade helping our warfighters.
I remain committed to the thing, to the cause. I teach about veterans at Loyola Marymount University. I mean, I left the VA, but I left my heart with them and took many of them with me.
Absolute pleasure getting to know you. Andrea Plait, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Dr. Skip Rizzo for sharing with me virtual reality therapy. And you can find out more about that at soldierstrong.org. Now, if you want to hear this show or find other episodes, you can go to connectingvets.com, search for the drop-down menu, and find the audio page where you'll find Eye on Veterans. In the meantime, I'm Phil Briggs, and I'll be searching for more great veterans with more great stories to tell for another edition of CBS Eye on Veterans.
Eye on Veterans Weekend has been presented by University of Maryland Global Campus. Choose from 90-plus programs and specializations to accelerate your military or civilian career, and find out how our dedicated military and veteran advisors can help you navigate your benefits to save you time and money. University of Maryland Global Campus. Find out how we're made for you. Visit umgc.edu.